Harsha's going to be doing the talk. Harsha is an activist in Sydney after moving from Melbourne. She's done a bunch of research about the politics of Indian self-determination and the movement for that, and also is an anti-racist activist. And this year she's the National Union of Students Ethno-Cultural Officer, which really means anti-racist officer. And actually she was re-elected after doing a triumphant job last year. So make her welcome and let's get ready for the talk.
Thanks, Omar. I just wanted to start by reading some of the stirring opening words of the founding charter of the United Nations, which was written in 1945 upon its formation. It says, "We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom." And this founding document contains a lot of fine words about the dedication of the United Nations to the promotion of human rights, to bring about an end to conflict and to bring together the international community. And I think in our world, which is full of horrors, the words of this charter about human rights and peace, they're pretty welcome to most. Global society today is more than ever racked with terrible crises like war, extreme poverty, and disease. Half the world's population still live on $2 to $10 a day. War and unrest is a constant feature of our global landscape, and this is only getting worse in the current period of crisis. In the past 15 years, Western countries have bombed the Middle East and sections of North Africa to control the region, while dictatorships like the Assad regime in Syria have enacted genocides against their own people. There's ethnic cleansing going on in Myanmar and many other places in the world, and whole areas are periodically engulfed in sectarian or communal strife that sees thousands die. And I think the majority of people in our world are decent, and they can see that cooperation would be far better than the merciless competition that has seen so many millions of lives taken in the last 100 years. And I think, you know, people see it would be far better if we all work together towards a better future. And the United Nations seems to be the embodiment of that cooperation and seems to provide a way forward towards global peace. And this is in the context of rightful cynicism about the role of powerful states like the US in world politics. The US has been so immoral in the way that it's conducted itself, toppling elected governments in Latin America and other places, invading and killing a million people in Iraq, not to mention that they propped up the spectre of atomic war for the better part of a century. The UN, by contrast, seems to be a vehicle for diplomacy, where nations can work out a peaceful solution to tensions. A quote from the UN Western Europe Regional Information Centre, aka Propaganda Centre, says that the process of nations working together over time builds trust, and it facilitates fast and transparent communication that raises the chance of resolving crises peacefully. And the UN presents itself as a neutral arbiter with the power to bring these warring nations to heel and, you know, point in its favour so far has prevented a worldwide conflagration on the scale of World War II. It also claims that its organs are independent and therefore can protect the rights of global citizens, and it also has huge agencies to eliminate social problems like rectifying world hunger and aiding refugees. So there's the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and pertinently for us in Australia, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. And actually, because of this, many progressive people recourse to the UN as a guarantor of peace and progress. And often a commitment to some righteous cause or another is backed up with reference to the UN. In Australia, a lot of people like to point out that the Australian government contravenes the UN Human Rights Declaration when it locks up refugees indefinitely. Progressive people and movements have actually made appeals to the UN in the name of justice. I was actually watching footage of the Selma to Montgomery march in 1965 for civil rights, and UN flags were being carried on this demonstration. I think there's a common sense that the United Nations, though sometimes thwarted by power-hungry leaders of various nations, will come down on the side of the people. But this talk will claim that the UN is not such an institution and that the charter I read out does not describe the capacity of the United Nations to achieve these lofty aims. Not only is it ineffective, But this document is actually 100% lies, deception and hypocrisy, because the UN has done far more harm to the cause of the oppressed than good. And it's not just a matter of giving the UN more powers to act against rogue warmongers or reforming the institution to be more democratic, because its inability to help the problems is structural. Because the United Nations is embedded into the system of competition between nations that's endemic to capitalism. I think looking at this, it's important to start with the founding of the United Nations, because it tells you a lot about this institution. The UN was not actually set up to fulfil any of the ideals in the Charter of International Cooperation, etc., but to assist the most powerful and bloodthirsty nations on the planet. And it was founded after the carnage of two world wars, ostensibly, like it said, to stop this from ever happening again. But in fact, it was not created in the interests of peace, but created by the winners of World War II to entrench their power and to help reshape the world in their interests. The US emerged primarily as the victor of World War II, and this was the nation that was able to dominate the world. And the US ruling class shaped a series of institutions to ensure its dominance, to open up markets in Europe and cultivate a block of allies based on the free market. And in the political sphere, it set up the United Nations to oversee this peace and make sure, ultimately, the interests of the US were legitimised and looked after. And as a matter of fact, in this, the United Nations had a predecessor, which can illustrate this, the League of Nations. This was formed in 1920, and this body collected the major powers together, those that had, you guessed it, won World War I. And they, too, made grand pronouncements about peace. But like after World War II, this was merely a ceasefire that was structured around the interests of Britain and France. It enforced the Treaty of Versailles that had been concluded only 6 days prior, which was anything but a just peace. Actually, it was about carving up the world between the victors of World War I and those who helped the British and were given colonies as prizes, including Australia, no democratic input whatsoever from the people that lived in those places. It also mandated crippling punishments on Germany that fell down hard on the German people. Russian revolutionary Lenin aptly called the League of Nations a thieves' kitchen. And unsurprisingly, given the reason for its formation, the League of Nations did not prevent conflicts, especially in places where Britain and France benefited little from intervening. So, you know, they just watched on as the Japanese army invaded Manchuria in 1931 and carried out massive atrocities. It was also the reality that the so-called peace between World War I and World War II couldn't actually last, since the tensions between Germany and Britain were far from resolved. These were tensions over resources and land with which they could use to expand their economies. And actually, a new arms race began, with Nazi Germany producing a lot of heavy weaponry and making inroads into other parts of Europe, and Britain responding in turn. So what was the response of the League of Nations to all of this? Far from ordering a disarmament of Britain and Germany, the League of Nations dissolved itself on the eve of war. So it's not a very effective organisation for peace. And I think the UN's very structure confirms its purpose as an organisation serving these major powers. There's actually no democracy or equality between states at all in the United Nations, which reflects the brutal reality of global capitalism. Some states are higher up on the imperialist ladder than others. The General Assembly, this is where most nations have a place, that passes hundreds of resolutions, but has no power to compel anyone to enforce these decisions. So, for example, the General Assembly passes many fine resolutions to support the right of Palestinians to resist Israeli occupation, but there's been no discernible improvement in Israel's behaviour towards the people it has colonised, and if anything, land theft and violence has gotten worse in this time. Basically, the General Assembly is a symbolic talk fest, where a bunch of decolonised nations get to sit at the table with the caveat that they pretty much have no power against the imperial bigwigs. And after the US overthrew the Grenada government in the 80s, President Reagan said of the General Assembly something which is so starkly true: 100 nations have not agreed with us on just about everything that's come before them where we're involved, and it didn't upset my breakfast at all. Real power instead lies with the Security Council, which does actually control an armed force, and it can decide on joint military action or economic sanctions. And therefore, it's a much, much more select group. There are 15 member states. And then there are only 5 permanent members of the Security Council. And these are, again, the victors of World War II, including the US. And these are permanent 5, henceforth known as P5, have veto power and use it to protect their interests. The US Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, after the war, he said in 1944, again, a very stark reality, pointing it out for all of us to see, the United States government would not remain one day in the United Nations without retaining the veto power. So an example of this, again, with reference to Palestine, the Security Council has consistently shot down any motions coming from the General Assembly that criticise Israel, since Israel is the US's major ally in the Middle East. It helps US interests in the Middle East. And in fact, the US has blocked 35 resolutions supporting Palestine between 1982 and 2015. And only those countries with the military power to secure their interests, the real meaning of security in this context, I think, have any real power in the Security Council and therefore in the United Nations in general. That is the P5 countries. Therefore, the Security Council actually can't resolve any of the conflicts in which the P5 have a stake. What about the Secretary General, you might ask? Well, the Security Council chooses the Secretary General anyway. Secretary General is dependent on the will of the powerful P5, powerless to stop the P5 from acting and, if anything, legitimises their crime. So the nature and structure of the UN, that partly explains world history from its founding up to the present moment. The United Nations has not been capable of stopping powerful states from doing whatever they want, whether that be war, economic domination of other countries, propping up dictators, the works. In the words of John Bolton, who is now a national security advisor to Trump, there is no United Nations. The first action of the United Nations was to defend the creation of the apartheid state of Israel in 1948, carried out by force, which expelled millions of Palestinians and has led to over 70 years of occupation and apartheid. During the Cold War, which emerged not long after, the UN could do nothing to lessen tensions between the US and the USSR because it was caught, again, between the interests of these two powerful states. And far from being an independent umpire that could de-escalate these tensions or disarm either power, it was totally ineffectual. Because the only power that the United Nations has derives from its constituent states, and especially those which are wealthy and better armed, aka the P5. And this is, meanwhile, the nuclear arms race is mounting. Both the US and the USSR are stockpiling weapons that could easily destroy the entire planet in mutually assured destruction. And the UN, as you can predict from the structure of the Security Council, is pretty much irrelevant in this context. And as for places where the US and the USSR don't have much of an interest, the Security Council just lets the P5 other members do whatever they like. So in 1953 in Kenya, the British crushed an anti-colonial rebellion very violently. France was able to use guerrilla warfare and torture against Algerian rebels trying to win their independence, and China annexed Tibet. Similarly, if the United Nations was really neutral and genuinely against injustice, it would have intervened against authoritarian and genocidal rulers elsewhere in the world. For example, the Shah in Iran, or Suharto in Indonesia. Well, actually, the United Nations did nothing to stop these oppressive rulers because these regimes were in some way associated with the US and their interests. And there are more examples of horrific wars that the UN was unwilling or unable to stop. You know, Vietnam, Iraq in 2003, I was just in a session about that. I could go on and on, really. But I wanted to say there's actually a more fundamental explanation for why the United Nations cannot override the drive to war. Capitalism is inherently very competitive. And just like companies compete with each other for a greater share of the market, for more and more profits, states, nation states, they compete on the world stage for resources and greater control and access to help their national economies do such things. And this competition, it can't always be peaceful, worked out at, you know, fancy forums and dinners and that kind of thing. It's negotiated on the basis of who has more economic muscle. But when it becomes more acute, when things are really coming to a head, it can only be resolved with a winner coming out on top militarily, that is, by war. And of course, in the early days of capitalism, this looked like powerful capitalist economies and their nation states scrambling for profits and conquering places around the world, grabbing land, resources, labour power, etc. But at some point, there is nothing new to claim. Essentially, the whole world is carved up between the major powers. But that competition between capitalist economies, it didn't stop. It just got violent, not just in the third world, but between major powers. And that was the origins of both World Wars I and II. And this is contra in a lot of ways to the common understanding of war and where it comes from. It's considered to be a policy choice adopted by warmongers like George Bush or like Hitler, and it's a product of their desire for power or their irrationality rather than something more systemic. And many have theorised that maybe capitalism doesn't even need war, that it would be better for all involved if you could just keep the economy running smoothly without the disruption that war brings. But, you know, that seems to make sense. But actually, imperialism is the logical endpoint of capitalist competition when it reaches a global scale. It's actually impossible to reconcile the endless accumulation of profits that's mandated by the structure of the capitalist economy and the existence of different national groups of capitalists. Years of patient diplomacy can't resolve imperialist conflicts because they come from the dynamics of capitalism itself. And there is no international community except what the US and other powers can try and dominate. And United Nations itself is an oxymoron. In fact, since capitalism and commodity production has reached basically every pore of this world, the conflicts between nations occur at an even deeper level than previously. Because nation states exist to guarantee the position of the capitalist class in their country. And once that state power gets involved, it's no longer a question of simply grabbing raw materials and labour like in the colonial era. It becomes a question of political positioning vis-a-vis other nation states. And having influence in the world with lesser nation states, it becomes just as important as direct economic control over resources. And this dynamic of imperialism has a military expression, which is the arms race. It's something deeply destructive and irrational, and in a way, you know, bad for business in the long run, but it epitomises the system of capitalism that we live in. This same competition on a global level between nation states, plus the legacies of colonialism, means that there is a hierarchy of nations, some poor, some wealthy and powerful. And, you know, there's whole sections of the globe that are relegated to extreme poverty, and that's an essential product of capitalism. Capitalism also produces migration to escape the poverty, the war, the persecution. And actually ending that crisis would involve ending the system of world imperialism. And to end imperialism, we need a society that's not based on capitalist competition, since imperialism and war is so bound up with the society that we live in. So, back to the United Nations. Even if the United Nations doesn't have the power to stop warmongers from warring, doesn't the UN at least try to help people around the world? Surely there's a humanitarian aspect to the United Nations. It's one of the key planks for them in their kind of founding charters, etc. I just wanted to point out, for starters, that the United Nations often gives a humanitarian seal of approval to military deployments that are anything but humanitarian. UN involvement in war doesn't actually make that war more just less politically risky for the nations that have a stake in it. And I think giving the illusion of collaboration to the military ventures of the US has a long history in the United Nations. And actually, the Cold War situation I described before didn't entirely paralyse the UN, because in 1950, the UN rubber-stamped a US-led war that devastated the Korean Peninsula and left it permanently divided, less than 10 years after the UN's founding. Nearly 5 million people died in 3 years. In fact, UN involvement is often sought by the US in order to make the war more palatable to the public, the gloss of humanitarianism covering for the self-interest of the US state. And a prime example is the Gulf War of 1990, for which the US bribed and threatened the various states on the Security Council with aid and influence in order to have its approval to intervene against Saddam Hussein, who was a former ally, actually, who went rogue in the eyes of the US. And this invasion was given a humanitarian edge by the UN, as if the US was intervening to stop a warmongering dictator from oppressing his own people. And actually, the United Nations helped to, they put sanctions on Iraq, which killed 500,000 children in the 90s. It's absolute genocide. And in the Security Council, Yemen, not one of the permanent members, it was the sole member of the Security Council to vote against the Gulf War. But that was at a cost. This vote actually cost Yemen $70 million in US aid. The US also instructed its ally, Saudi Arabia, to expel 800,000 Yemeni workers from the country. And the representative of the US in the Security Council told their Yemeni counterpart, that was the most expensive no vote you ever cast. So the UN actually helped the US to legitimise a new era of US ground invasion from that time. And the US is very conscious of the important role of the UN as, you know, a fig leaf over its crimes. A UN official said this before the Iraq War of 2003, by going to the United Nations, we're trying to make people more comfortable with what we're trying to do. Quite bold and bland. So quite apart from the wars of the US, there are plenty of regional conflicts in the world, though, that the UN, in its stated goals, they attempt to bring to a swift resolution and help people in the area with aid. So these are the peacekeeping missions. And these are places on the fringes of world imperialism, and these conflicts often involve wars between smaller nations or ethnic or sectarian or communal conflicts or anti-colonial revolts. And the forces that intervene into these missions are the UN peacekeeping forces. There's about 120,000 of them in Africa right now. And the lie that gets told about these forces is that they're non-partisan and they're there to guarantee safety and security of the population in areas of unrest, civil war or state violence. However, these forces are in no way a neutral force. Member states actually contribute parts of their armed forces towards the peacekeepers, and forces are not really any different to any other army. Peacekeeping missions still bring more guns and firepower into regions that are already riven with armed conflict. And the potential, therefore, for the same human rights abuses as armed interventions by individual member states exists, as I hope to point out. And these peacekeeping forces are sent in by the Security Council. It's actually the only part of the UN empowered to do that, as I said. So, of course, they intervene in ways that suit the major imperialist powers, the countries that dominate the Security Council. So I'll give an example to illustrate this. It's a particularly horrific one, actually. Peacekeeping forces were sent into Somalia to intervene in 1992. And this was ostensibly to deliver aid to people who were suffering from a famine that was killing 2,000 people every day. For that, though, the peacekeepers had to separate the warring factions in Somalia. And to do that, they ended up killing 10,000 people in this mission in just 6 months. And the real interest of the US and therefore the UN in this area was certainly not actually humanitarian. The strategic location of Somalia was just as important. It was paramount for the US, which, you know, after the collapse of the USSR, to be top dog in the world, to police everywhere in the world and control it, to maintain that position. And Somalia was no exception. Therefore, the real aim was to install the US's preferred military faction into power in Somalia, and the UN troops invaded and occupied to help further this aim. And it's not much an exaggeration to say that in these UN peacekeeping missions that basically like a new colonialism is set up, and UN forces inevitably bring all the horrors of the colonial era back into these countries. There's inherent in this idea of humanitarian intervention an assumption of moral superiority over backward third world people who are always fighting amongst themselves. And that myth actually covers for some of the most atrocious racism, the idea that these people can't look after themselves. And actually, child prostitution rings are found to have skyrocketed in 6 out of 12 countries where the UN engaged in humanitarian concerns in Africa. And Dutch peacekeepers in Somalia, this is horrific, were found to have kidnapped a small boy and slowly roasted him over a fire. There's photos of this as well. And in most places, the UN ends up, but they rightfully become hated for the role that they play. People themselves don't want this humanitarian so-called intervention. In some places, in Somalia, the UN forces were pelted with stones as they left the places where they were occupying. UN forces also shot at those protests that were directed against the UN intervention. And I think we should have respect, actually, for the political agency of those in the third world rather than seeing them as hapless victims in need of more oppression, actually, by the might of major imperialist countries. And the causes of the conflict that they face, they need a political, not a military solution to show an alternative future. The US is not the only country that the UN intervenes in support of. It also serves less powerful forces than the US. So in our own backyard, in East Timor, the UN actually played a great service for Australian imperialism. After the successful independence referendum overseen by the UN in 1999, the Indonesian military retaliated against the East Timorese. The Security Council authorised a peacekeeping force, again, led by Australia, to invade East Timor, ostensibly to restore peace and security. However, Australian presence under UN mandate has actually never left Timor-Leste, and besides, they came in after the worst of the killings were over, killing sprees at the hands of the Indonesian military, which, factually, they'd never really minded before. Australia would have preferred Timor under the thumb of Indonesia rather than being rocked by an independence movement. And this is Australia defending its interests in this very strategically important area with UN backing as well. It's the case that Australia has virtually unrestricted access to East Timorese resources, such as natural gas. The United Nations, this is the last thing about humanitarian intervention, they've actually played an extremely sinister role in the anti-colonial revolts of the 20th century as well. This is a really disturbing example from the Congo in 1960. So in this year, the Belgians were finally forced out of this region that they'd violently ruled over in an anti-colonial struggle. And the Congolese people elected the radical leader Patrice Lumumba, while the Belgians, what they did, they weren't just like, that's fine, whatever, we'll leave. They regrouped in a mineral-rich region of the Congo and launched a war on the new government. And so Lumumba, he was a radical, but didn't necessarily understand the role of the UN. So he appealed to the UN for military aid and to call out the peacekeeping forces to help the Congolese people achieve their national liberation. Instead, the UN basically did everything in their power to prevent Lumumba's victory over the Belgians. Moreover, in the UN General Assembly, the US, Britain, and Belgium successfully manoeuvred to have Lumumba's government declared illegitimate. For the crime of refusing to be a Western puppet, shortly thereafter, Lumumba was kidnapped and murdered by the very same UN forces he'd appealed to for help. And the same kind of thing has happened countless times, Angola, 1991, and various other times. So peacekeeping, I think, means keeping the peace in a way that benefits the imperialist powers, not that the side of justice wins. So much for the lofty words of the UN founding charter about self-determination. The reality is no major power on earth benefited from anti-colonial struggle that could upset their interests in the region and be an inspiration for struggle elsewhere in the world, and they wanted it all crushed. So that's the armed forces, but there's also various agencies like UNICEF and UNHCR and UN, the Women's Rights Association, they seem a bit more benign. And they run massive humanitarian operations to end child poverty, to provide shelter to millions of refugees, etc. And they're staffed by thousands of people that are fairly dedicated. And though they do some work which is not entirely disagreeable, I think these agencies provide more cover for the institution as a whole. I think they can't fix the problems caused by global capitalism like poverty because they're endemic, like I described before. But this is especially so on their budgets, which are small relative to the problem, and also their bureaucratic methods of operation. Actually, more of their funds go to maintaining offices and bureaucracies than actually to delivering aid. Plus, I think they remove responsibility from the 1% in the states that they operate in to provide social assistance to the poor and refugees. Moreover, their operations are subordinated, like absolutely everything else in the UN, to the needs of the P5 Security Council members. In fact, they often accompany and soften the image of military intervention and operation either by the peacekeeping forces or the armies of member states. And nor do they point out human rights or environmental abuses that might embarrass the major powers either. These agencies are also deeply corrupt. There's competition between departments for funding from member states. Member states themselves, they vie for posts for their upwardly mobile citizens. And I think as well, they're part and parcel of that neocolonial type relationship between UN forces and third world countries. Their aid agencies are run like rackets. Actually, they create a clientelist relationship with the oppressed in various countries because they can literally get help from nowhere else. And this unequal power dynamic and relationship of dependence produces dehumanisation and racist attitudes, just like what we saw for the peacekeeping forces. And sexual violence and trafficking abounds in these agencies, and they're no better than the NGOs like the Red Cross that were exposed at the beginning of last year. The UN agencies, just like the peacekeeping forces, contribute more harm than good. So there's clearly a lot of problems with the United Nations, and a lot of people who've become disillusioned while working within them, they seek reform to the problems that I've identified. And the reforms that they propose, removing veto power, expanding the Security Council, etc., they all sound like genuinely fine things to propose because they would undercut the power of the major nations in the UN. But that's precisely why these reforms can never happen. The UN was designed this way for a reason. The only power, as I said before, within the United Nations comes from the material advantage of the powerful nations within it, the wealth, the arms. And in general, it's not moral or legal authority that runs this world. Rather, the more materially powerful a nation is, the more it gets to decide what is legal and moral in the eyes of the world. And the US runs the UN because it already runs the world. And where they don't run it, there are other aggressive and oppressive states to fill the gap. So to reform the UN, you'd somehow have to override all of their interests. And nice liberal pariahs really won't cut it. Because the bare reality is that the UN defends an international order of war and oppression. And instead of a democratisation of the UN, we need a democratisation of the society that it rests on. So to conclude, I think as well as its role propping up imperialism, the UN plays an important ideological role for the capitalist system, which helps to explain the enduring popularity of this body, and as well as another reason why the ruling class will seek to maintain it. It seems to show that there are structures in place, though imperfect, that exist to look after human interests, a powerful idea in a world that's so awful. Moreover, the United Nations suggests that the resolution of the conflicts and problems in global society is best left to a cabal of experts. And smart and talented people, they know their stuff and they'll look after the world for us. And if you want to make change, you should aspire towards posts in these institutions as well. These institutions, after all, are where power lies, and that power can be used for good. And in reality, whatever power is embodied in the UN is counterposed to our interests. Even the lesser nations which jostle for positions in the Security Council are not motivated in any way by democratic concerns, but play out their own imperialist game in the halls of the UN as well. And all of the states in the United Nations General Assembly are based on the class elite of each country that oppress their people, exploit the working class, and their power on the world stage in no way benefits any of us. We need to go well beyond the UN if we want to see an end to the urgent social political questions of our time. We can't rely on institutions set up by the powerful to undo problems of their own making. And of course, saying this, you know, it's not just being nihilistic to critique the UN or embracing imperialist war as somehow inevitable, nor do we line up with the right in their attacks on the UN as a global conspiracy for one world government or whatever. We defend the principles that are commonly but mistakenly attributed to the UN, unlike the right that would prefer that human rights towards refugees and others was a question erased from the political agenda. But we do need to understand the actual role that the United Nations plays and pose a different course for left-wing people. Because the myths about the United Nations, they mask a genuine alternative to the status quo. Instead of the UN, we need to confront the deadly rivalry that's inherent in this system with our own solidarity across borders with the oppressed. We need to oppose the states that initiate war, and we need mass resistance to the war machine to disrupt its functioning. And this is especially so in the West, where our rulers are responsible for the vast majority of suffering of people on the planet. The power we need to have should come from our own power, mass movements that we have to build. In fact, the real peacekeepers in history have been the global working class, actually, and movements of the oppressed. The anti-Vietnam War movement, for example, of the late 60s and early 70s, brought masses of students, workers and others across the world demonstrating in their millions against the war, joining up with the peasant resistance itself in Vietnam. And the movement placed the blame absolutely where it lies, the US, the Australian states, and tried to disrupt their war machines by protesting weapons companies as well. and supported the struggles of the Vietnamese people against the racism that sought to dehumanise them. They actually challenged that. And these factors and the brutality of the war itself brought a revolt amongst the deployed GIs, actually, in Vietnam, that made it untenable for the US to keep fighting the war. And I think if you want to talk about an effective anti-war organisation, talk about the European workers' movement at the end of World War I. The revolutionary workers' movement in Russia and Germany 100 years ago stopped a world war in its tracks. And that was through strikes, mass demonstrations, and a bid for power that was not based on the capitalist elite, the very people had led them into war. It was based, and this is the reason why it was so successful, on workers' power, which was about abolishing the society that creates war in the first place. They wanted to build a socialist society, and for that they needed class war, not imperialist war. And even now, a strong bottom-up movement against imperialism can actually contribute to a new kind of society in the long run. We need to build up opposition to the US and Australian war machines, first and foremost. We need to stand with Palestine where the elites are uninterested. While the UN and other institutions of the system, they continue going about doing what they were built to do, let's have no illusions in them and go forward on the basis of genuine solidarity and internationalism. And I'll leave it there.